my hobby, as you described it, of writing, an artistic project, because it is art that gives us the tools through which we can explore the vision for a better future. And that I think, is a tremendously important task.
We've been speaking with author, playwright, and major economist Professor Tim Jackson. He directs the Center for Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity. Tim's new book, just out, is Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism. Find links for Tim Jackson and his work at timjackson.org.uk and more of my review at ecoshock.org. Tim, we really appreciate sharing time with you. Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Can we humans plan to avoid a catastrophe of our own making? Shall we redefine the future or wait until disasters rule us? A reduction of human numbers and impact seems inevitable either way. Two young scientists look at the pathway that the United Nations and national governments refuse to consider. Manfred Lenzen is professor of sustainability research at the University of Sydney. His partner and lead author is Lawrence Kaiser. Lawrence specializes in environmental systems and policy at ETH Zurich. They explain the challenges and need for degrowth to really keep global climate change below 2 degrees C. From Zurich, Switzerland, Lawrence Kaiser, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, all my life, Lawrence, every expert, politician, and talking head, they sell me on growth. Business wants to sell more, institutions want to grow, people want bigger houses and cars. When we are this deep into the growth model of how everything is supposed to work, Lawrence, how can we begin to think about living the opposite?
I totally understand this thing, because indeed, many things, if we look around us, they point into this direction of more and more growth and consumption and production, etc. But I think there are still many things or ways to start to think about something else. And first of all, I think it's important to emphasize that degrowth, in this sense, is not the opposite of growth. It really means something different in this sense. It implies reduced energy and material consumption, and in this sense, less consumption and production overall. But it also means changing the way the economy works, how our systems provide for us in terms of well-being. And in this sense, it really focuses a lot on increasing equality, focusing on well-being and democracy, really. And in this sense, it really is fundamentally different to just increasing more or reducing this consumption. In this sense, it's really about emancipating people, coming together, choosing less or working less in this sense. So how do we begin to think about this? I think there are really many hopeful things which we can detect if we look around in our daily lives. People, you know, choosing to work less, spend less money instead spend more time with friends and family, to repair things, care for loved ones, having a garden, you know, or pensioners committed to community work. And also people's movements, like protesting for climate justice in the Sunrise Movement or for a Green New Deal in the U.S., and also even Black Lives Matter. These are all things which resonate, you know, with the call for global socio-ecological justice, which degrowth stands for.
You know, it seems to me for a while, from my perspective in North America at least, degrowth was a bigger movement. In 2010, I recorded and broadcast a degrowth conference in Vancouver. There were international conferences in Paris and Barcelona. We heard less, I thought, but now degrowth is rising again. Lawrence, why do you think that is?
I'm not particularly familiar with the history of degrowth in the U.S., But at least from my perspective in Europe, it wasn't really gone. I mean, it's a very young concept. It only originated sort of the English word degrowth or sustainable degrowth, the concept sustainable degrowth, only originated in 2001. And the first academic conference on the topic, which sort of brought the concept into the scientific discussion, was in 2008 in Paris. Sort of in the same year, 2008-2009, the global financial crisis happened, and this helped propose this concept to more and more people, because it really sort of showed that the criticisms of degrowth weren't quite wrong, right? They showed that sort of this system based on perpetual growth really has its issues and crises, which in the end failed people. And with time, you know, more and more people came to experience the concept and get to know it. 2014 was the conference in Leipzig in Germany with really thousands of people. And it seems that sort of the concept gained in popularity since then, also because we sort of see the crisis worsen, standard approaches not being enough. A few countries have reduced carbon emissions, but not nearly enough as we would need. So all these things showing that there might be something correct about the analysis that the degrowth movement is proposing. So more and more social movements taking up the idea. As I said, Sunrise or also the Fridays for Future movement, climate strikes, but also other movements focusing on living better with less, such as the Transition Towns movement or generally downshifting and minimalism. All these things grew in popularity, and I think this is one of the reasons why it's gaining in popularity, because its analysis proves more and more correct in this sense, and now also COVID has shown again sort of that care, labor, and healthy relationships to ecosystems are really crucial. And these are two things that degrowth really focuses on too.
But why do you say degrowth needs a movement? I mean, couldn't a dictator or even a president during a crisis just order reduced consumption and less energy be used? Why do we need a movement?
First of all, again, I think degrowth really is more than just less production and consumption. In the degrowth concept, which we discuss, it's really the focus on more democratic systems where people collectively come together and decide on the limits they want to impose and to enable freedom within these limits. In this sense, you probably could have a dictator imposing limits, but it would be a miserable and highly unequal experience. Because in the end, who would this dictator exclude? Who would he favor? All these discussions would probably not be taken into account. And it would most likely not be accepted by people. You know, we see this right now with COVID measures, where people really criticize undemocratic procedures and do not accept the measures, which in the end leads to more dead people. And therefore, sort of, degrowth really focuses on enabling more people participating in the decisions which affect them, also in order to increase the acceptance and to lead to these cultural and value changes which are necessary for everyone to have a good life with less material consumption, because otherwise people will just experience it as top-down imposed against their will, and this is not what degrowth stands for.
I totally agree. I don't think it'll work unless people are willing to make the changes. You can't force this. Now, getting to climate, the only climate organization recognized by governments is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the so-called Conference of the Parties. Have either of these considered or studied degrowth as part of the big solution for global warming?
Maybe implicitly. There is a big role for reducing material and energy consumption. For instance, in the 2018 special report on the 1.5 degree target by the IPCC, there was the low energy demand scenario, this is the name, which drastically reduces material and energy consumption and thereby leading to less ambitious increases in terms of renewable energy and also negative emission technologies. but it never features sort of explicitly. And also in this scenario, in the low energy demand scenario, I have to add, this is combined with increasing global growth in consumption and production. So this is not really a degrowth scenario. So there is not an explicit discussion of degrowth in the IPCC, and this was the starting point also for our paper, because we wanted to look at the potential of degrowth in addressing the challenges which we face in mitigating climate change, and which we saw here was overlooked.
Okay, well, before we get too deep, Lawrence, let's be real. Are we talking about an interesting, admirable theory like science fiction? Or do you and Manfred really believe degrowth could happen?
I personally can't speak for my co-author, Manfred Lenzen, but I personally do believe it can happen in this direction here in Europe, and from afar, also a little in the U.S., so I really think that this has potential and it can change things for the better. But we definitely need a lot more people working and thinking on this.
Well, the only case of national degrowth I can remember was in the early 1990s when the former Soviet Union collapsed. Production crashed, greenhouse gas emissions fell sharply, and so did life expectancy for people in Russia. Is that degrowth?
This is exactly not degrowth. This is sort of decline by disaster, really, and exactly the scenario, actually, which degrowth wants to avoid, because it really defines itself in terms of maintaining well-being while reducing the environmentally harmful activities. So this is really the best counterexample for degrowth, really a crash, unplanned, unorganized, undemocratic in this sense, and really not focusing on the things that matter for people.
I guess a similar case, official figures say global economic activity fell about 4% during the pandemic year of 2020. Did we just get a taste of degrowth there?
Exactly. Also here, degrowth was often sort of conflated with this recession. Really, this is the correct term for this, an unplanned reduction in economic activity. And really, degrowth tries to address these processes by, you know, focusing on policies and changes that improve people's lives, maintain employment, and, for instance, guarantee people access to the services they need, healthcare, transport, etc., to really reduce this anxiety people have from facing a recession. This is really designed to prevent these effects.
Remember, you can listen to all past Radio EcoShock programs absolutely free at our website, ecoshock.org. You don't have to sign in or sign up. Just click to listen, or you can download the audio of all our expert guests, ecoshock.org. So in 2020, 1,100 experts and over 70 organizations from 60 countries published an open letter calling for degrowth as the way forward from the COVID-19 crisis. Instead, a lot of governments denounced huge spending to restore the growth economy. What could we be doing instead, Lawrence?
There are many, many things which could be done differently. I think there were also other open letters published proposing exactly different changes, which differ exactly from these huge spending to restore GDP growth. And that we could really have a discussion, an open discussion in our societies about what's really important for us and how we want to go forward to live together. I'm pretty sure that this would result in very different measures, for instance, focused on a Green New Deal without growth, investing heavily in renewable energy and having the discussion, you know, what do we want to invest in? Then focus on what really matters for people, you know, implementing working time reductions, fostering care work in the education and healthcare sector, for instance, or introducing a universal basic income. These discussions, which now sound far removed, but are partly implemented in different contexts worldwide already, could work really well to improve people's lives while reducing the impact on the environment. not a return to normal, back to normal, but would be maybe a better scenario.
What about green growth, Lawrence? Is that the same or different than degrowth?
It's certainly different to degrowth. It's sort of the currently dominant or mainstream approach to talking about or addressing environmental issues, which means that sort of we try to make economic growth increases in GDP compatible with environmental sustainability, for instance, by investing in renewable energy and energy efficiency. These investments are also often thought to spur economic growth, sort of to combine having jobs and the environment. This is very different to degrowth because degrowth really says that, you know, what's important for people's happiness and well-being, especially in rich countries in the global north, is not more GDP growth. It doesn't really correlate anymore with these measures of quality of life. And instead, we should really focus on the things that matter in terms of environmental sustainability without regarding GDP growth as a goal, and just implement these things which are right in these dimensions. And if, you know, if GDP declines, then that's okay, because it really isn't what matters to people. It's very different to green growth.
We have to be able to ask the hard questions, and one of them is, could the transition to renewables actually increase economic growth and all the problems that come with that?
Definitely. If we invest in renewable energy, this will feature in GDP as an increase. However, the question is whether we could do this fast enough and extensively enough to really meet the climate targets, especially where 1.5 degrees or well below 2 degrees. And there, you know, current evidence really suggests that this is not feasible, not possible, not taking into account, you know, all the issues around rare earth metal extraction and the conflicts which arise from that. And here the evidence really suggests that this is most likely not possible, especially if we take into account equity concerns, which really show that richer people and countries really have a deep responsibility to reduce even faster. Still, why should we focus on GDP growth, which includes things which actually harm people? Like if we have more car accidents and we need to buy more cars and repair more cars, then this features positively in GDP growth. So this is really a goal which should be questioned a lot more than it is currently. And then we would focus on different things, also on increasing renewable energy for sure, but also other things which make it a lot easier to decarbonize, for instance, questioning luxury consumption, such as private jets from billionaires. You know, these are all things which we could question and decarbonize much, much faster in terms of just replacing coal power with renewable energy is much easier than replacing current aviation with renewable fuels. So this could really speed up decarbonization a lot.
Before the pandemic struck, this civilization was already driving hard towards a collapse for a long list of reasons. Now I hear politicians and media and everybody around me saying, let's get back to normal. But that was heading for disaster normal. How can we communicate the possibilities of a simpler life, stepping lightly on the earth? And is that what you are partly proposing?
Yes, I think really the saying fits well. You know, the rich must live more simply in order for everyone else to simply live. This simpler life in terms of material services is one goal or element of degrowth. But I think what degrowth does well, also in choosing this term really, which evokes usually rather negative associations with people, is to argue that this can actually really be something positive, you know, that this does not mean that we go back to living in caves, but the caves in which we are going to live, they have internet, they are well heated, they have transport for everyone, healthcare, education, etc. So this is really high living standards maintained with a lot lower energy consumption and consumption overall. And this is really, I think, the core communicational asset of degrowth, to turn something currently negative into really aspirational goal and something positive to look forward to. This is in part what degrowth is proposing, to live simpler but better. I would really stress that this also incorporates, you know, addressing current power structures and changing the economic system, and not only focusing, you know, on the individual here, but because everyone also really faces a lot of obstacles to doing this. You know, not everyone can buy organic food and et cetera. And it's wrong, I think, to reduce sustainability to that.
To be honest, though, Lawrence, your paper is difficult. It's not one that I could just say to listeners, well, go read this paper, because you're dealing with so many variables. The whole trying to see the future, it's really complex. For example, you say a focus on well-being instead of economic production is essential to growing smaller in a positive way. Why do we have to consider that when we're looking at the big economy and where we want to go?
Focus on well-being is really a crucial part of degrowth, because currently the focus is not directly on well-being, on you know, satisfying human needs around education, transport, and food, and also discussing, you know, what are these needs really, and how can we satisfy them in a way that's not detrimental to our livelihood. Currently, we are not focusing on well-being. We focus on GDP growth, on maintaining profits for companies, on maintaining jobs, of course, because if we are lacking growth currently, this means more unemployment. So the question degrowth asks really, how can we decouple well-being from growth, and how can we have the education, the healthcare, and all that while even if GDP declines? And this is sort of the key task, because oftentimes what we see is that focusing on GDP growth really prevents the necessary action in terms of climate mitigation, you know, that we don't introduce the incredibly high carbon taxes or carbon fee and dividends, because this is feared to have a negative impact on growth and leading to job losses, etc. So degrowth proposes, you know, just focus on the things that are well-being, and introduce the ecological measures, and we will be fine, but even as GDP declines in the process. So I really think this focus on well-being is absolutely crucial to tackling the environmental crisis which we currently face.
On this program, we had Timothy Garrett from the University of Utah. He explained his formula showing energy and gross domestic product are intimately tied together. It's not a simple formula, but it does work on historic data. And Garrett shows that with energy and production, if you increase one or decrease one, the other follows in the same direction. Have you encountered Garrett's work?
I have encountered Timothy Garrett, I think, only via Twitter. Not so much his academic work, but I think his thesis, which sort of aims at, as you said, the connection between economic growth and energy consumption, is very prominent also in our paper, and we therefore focus a lot on how sort of energy efficiency gains, for instance, often lead to economic growth and thus again to more energy consumption, which supports this thesis that GDP growth and energy growth develop in the same direction, which is, as you said, also what we observe empirically.
A recent article in the New York Times cites a series of authorities predicting surprising population decline. I'm not sure that I believe it, but that's what they say. Would degrowth of the human population itself help our battle to preserve a livable planet? What do you think?
In our paper, we really didn't focus on population growth. And this is due to some reasons, I think, because first of all, many other papers, publications show that although population growth is a factor in environmental impacts, it's by far not the dominant one, which is sort of affluence or per capita consumption, really, which we can also see in the distribution of global carbon emissions between 1990 and 2015. the global top 1% income earners were responsible for twice as much cumulative carbon as the poorest half of humanity, right? So this is really huge disparities there. And really, as you said, that globally, increasing rates of population are slowing down. And it's certainly, in this sense, making things easier for environmental targets. But we really think that to address this issue, we should more or less avoid talking about population growth, because it is itself a quite risky concept, because it directly invokes the question who is too much, you know, which populations, and it's easily sort of the doorway for more racist or anti-immigrant positions. And in this sense, we should focus more on what matters for population growth, which is women's emancipation and empowerment, and also affluence, sort of how rich these populations are. Here we can really focus, you know, on family planning and education, particularly for women.
In this sense, has a lot of co-benefits, right? It really is unquestionably just, and we don't risk other talking points which can be problematic, but really focusing on the things that matter, like women's emancipation and more equal distributions of power and incomes and etc., can really lead to much bigger outcomes, avoiding the negative issues which are associated with population growth.
Final question. Tell us about the climate protest you attended recently.
This was last Friday, which was the national climate strike or climate protest here in Switzerland, organized by the climate strike movement, which originated sort of from the Fridays for Future youth climate movement. It was a very rainy day. We were hours out there in the rain, but with thousands of people here in Zurich, and it was really a great atmosphere, and yeah, really making a lot of hope for positive change in the future. This was really great experience, and good to sort of bring the results of science directly to the application of the project. This was really great.
We have been with Lawrence Kaiser, a student at ETH Zurich. He leads the new paper titled 1.5 Degrees Degrowth Scenarios Suggest the Need for New Mitigation Pathways, as published in Nature Communications, May 11, 2021. Find links to the paper and further research geared to listeners in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Lawrence, thank you for helping us grow a little less.
Thanks so much for having me and the interesting questions.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwoods and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities, and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.